So as Andrew said, we're continuing our series in 1 Kings. But just to get us back into the world of 1 Kings, I want to remind you, rather I want to get you to remind each other about how great King Solomon was. So I reckon there's enough people in the church who were here for earlier in our series who will know. And if you don't know and you're totally stuck, then just look at the beginning of chapter 10 for some clues. I want you to just share with each other a couple of things that were so excellent, so great about the reign of King Solomon. In some ways, the high point of the whole of the history of God's people in the Israelites. What was so good about Solomon? Just buzz for a couple of minutes around where you are. If you're stuck, look at the beginning of chapter 10. Off you go. Anyone want to shout out some highlights of the reign of King Solomon? What was so good about his reign? Yeah, everyone was happy. The whole country, every person was happy. Very unusual political regime in that respect. Yeah. Say again. Lots of gold. Yes, yeah, so about £1 billion a year of imports for his personal wealth. One of the richest men ever, probably the richest man ever if you account for historical context. Yeah. Very wealthy, very happy citizens. He's very wise, so he asked God back in chapter 3. God said, you've got one wish, you can ask for anything you like. He said, I'd like wisdom. And so we hear that his wisdom was more than the sand on the seashore. Yeah, anything else? Peace. Yeah, there was no war. He was, partly because no one would be stupid enough to take him on. I mean, he was a brilliant military strategist, built chariot cities where he could have control of the whole surrounding area. You can see some of them still today. The archaeology is still intact. He was a wise, powerful, rich king, and under his reign, Israel was at the height of its prosperity, and yet everything was about to change, and so please turn to chapter 11 and let's read from verse 1. Now King Solomon loved many foreign women along with the daughter of Pharaoh, Moabite, Ammonite, Edomite, Sidonian, and Hittite women, from the nations concerning which the Lord had said to the people of Israel, you shall not enter into marriage with them, neither shall they with you, for surely they will turn away your heart after their gods. Solomon clung to these in love. He had 700 wives who were princesses and 300 concubines. And his wives turned away his heart. For when Solomon was old, his wives turned away his heart after other gods, and his heart was not wholly true to the Lord as his God, as was the heart of David his father. For Solomon went after Ashtoreth, the goddess of the Sidonians, and after Milcom, the abomination of the Ammonites. So Solomon did what was evil in the sight of the Lord, and did not wholly follow the Lord, as David his father had done. Then Solomon built a high place for Chemosh, the abomination of Moab, for Molech, the abomination of the Ammonites, on the mountain east of Jerusalem. And so he did for all his foreign wives who made offerings and sacrificed to their gods. And the Lord was angry with Solomon because his heart had turned away from the Lord, the God of Israel, who had appeared to him twice and had commanded him concerning this very thing, that he should not go after other gods. But he did not keep what the Lord commanded. Therefore the Lord said to Solomon, since this has been your practice, and you have not kept my covenant and my statutes that I've commanded you, I will surely tear the kingdom from you and will give it to your servant. Yet, for the sake of David your father, I will not do it in your days. I'll tear it out of the hand of your son. However, I will not tear away all the kingdom. I'll give one tribe to your son, for the sake of David my servant, and for the sake of Jerusalem, whom I have chosen. And the Lord raised up an adversary against Solomon, Hadad the Edomite, and so on. C.S. Lewis, the famous Christian writer who, I guess, most famous for The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe and the Narnia stories, but wrote a whole series of Christian books, one of which is called the Screwtape Letters. And it's some of you are nodding. In fact, some of us from Grace Church Greenwich went to see a performance, a staged version of the Screwtape Letters a couple of years ago. The premise of the book is that it's a collection of letters written from a senior demon called Screwtape to his nephew, a junior demon called Wormwood, about his job. And all demons have the job of tempting and enticing away Christians. and tried to shipwreck their faith in Jesus. And so Wormwood has this particular Christian he's assigned to, and his uncle, Screwtape, writes to him saying, this is what I advise, or this is how you should proceed in this case. And it's a sort of, it's a very clever book. So of course, it's written by a Christian to Christians to say, wouldn't it be helpful to know the enemy's tactics? This is like an intercept of the internal communications of the demonic world. And I wonder if you can put yourself for a moment in Wormwood's shoes and imagine that the Christian you're assigned to, if you are a Christian here today, not everyone will be, but imagine that the Christian that you're assigned to is yourself. Can you see what I mean? So if I'm Andrew Satch, instead of being Andrew Satch, imagine that I am the demon assigned to the case of Andrew Satch, and so on for each of you here today. And the question is, what would be your best strategy to tempt this particular Christian, i.e. yourself? If your job was to shipwreck, in my case, Andrew Satch's Christian life, to pull him away from Jesus, to cause his heart to turn against him, what would you choose? What advice would you give to a junior demon assigned to your case? Well, maybe you think it could never happen. And the idea of, I fall into temptation sometimes and there's things I need to confess at church sometimes, but the idea of being totally pulled away from Jesus, I just don't think that's going to happen. I mean, to be honest, when I look at what happened to Solomon in this chapter, it seems rather extreme. You may have heard about some of these gods he goes after, worships, people like Molech, who was famous for demanding child sacrifices. And you think, honestly, I can pretty much guarantee I'm not going to turn my back on Jesus Christ in order to become, say, a fundamentalist Muslim of the fly a plane into a tower variety. It's just not going to happen. Trust me. I'm not even remotely tempted to worship a God that demands child sacrifice. This is really extreme. It's a sort of cartoon version, and I'm absolutely safe. The trouble with that, the idea of thinking, you know, Solomon was an idiot, and I'll do much better, is that we've already been told in this book that Solomon was the wisest man who ever lived. Solomon is his pen gave us, amongst other things, the book of the Proverbs, the book of the Bible that is full of how to live a wise life, how to keep away from foolishness. He's not an idiot. He's successful. He's wise. He's spiritually insightful. And yet in this chapter, he has an absolute car crash Christianly. What is it that brings him down? And what is it that would bring you down if you're a Christian here this afternoon? Well, in the spirit of C.S. Lewis's Screwtape, I've rather perversely given us points that we don't want to follow, but this is the way to fall away. If you want to ruin your life, this is how to do it. Three bits of advice. Number one, ignore the warnings. Ignore the warnings. And the picture there of those two rectangles, this is about as advanced as my attempt to draw with computer art gets. This is meant to be two dominoes, and they're side-on, because otherwise I'd have to do all the circles for the dots, and that'd be too complicated. But it's a side-on picture of two dominoes, and one of them has started to fall, and it's propped up against the other one. And the concept I want to get across here is that there's two things in this passage that Solomon does wrong. The first one is that he marries other women, in fact, 700 other women. And the second one is that he starts worshipping gods like Molech. And they're like two dominoes standing side by side in a domino run. And as one topples, the other one follows. And the point about these dominoes is one of them seems very, very extreme, worshipping a child sacrifice demanding deity. That's extreme. And the other one seems altogether normal, falling in love. And what could be more normal than falling in love? But the point of the chapter is that the falling in love turns into the worship of a child sacrificing evil, fake God. One domino falls over, and the other domino is inevitably going to fall over. But the first domino is the domino that has a warning. God says, do not intermarry with them. Do not form marriage alliances with people from these other countries. If you do, then they'll turn your heart away. So, for example, listen to the words of Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy chapter 7. When the Lord your God brings you into the land you're entering to take possession of it, clears away the many nations before you, the Hittites, Girgashites, Amorites, Canaanites, Perizzites, Hivites, Jebusites, seven nations more numerous and mightier than you. And when the Lord your God gives them over to you and you defeat them, you shall make no covenant with them. You must show no mercy to them. You shall not intermarry with them, giving your daughters to their sons or taking their daughters for your sons, for they would turn away your sons from following me to serve other gods. And the anger of the Lord will be kindled against you, and you will be destroyed quickly. Passage from the books of the law and Deuteronomy, many years before Solomon, books in which Solomon will be an expert, a wise man who knew God's word. He'd have known the book of Deuteronomy. There's the warning. Or listen to the words of Exodus. And we've already heard an excerpt from it at the beginning of our service. You shall worship no other god, for the Lord, whose name is jealous, is a jealous God, lest you make a covenant with the inhabitants of the land, and when they whore after their gods and sacrifice to their gods, and you're invited, you join in the sacrifice. You take of their daughters for your sons, and their daughters whore after their gods, and your sons whore after their gods. So twice in the Old Testament, in the law, we're told a warning. Don't form a marriage alliance with people who don't worship the same God as you. Don't share your life with somebody who's aligned towards a different God, a false God. Because if you do, here's the warning, if you do that, you'll end up following their gods too. To put it in modern terms, I guess you'd say to a Christian, don't marry somebody who isn't devoted to the Lord Jesus. Don't share your life with somebody who's not going in the same direction as you, spiritually speaking. Because if you do, then they'll turn your heart away from the Lord. And even as I say that, I bet there are some people in this room who are thinking, nah, I don't think they will. No, I think I'll be okay. I get the warning. I can see how for maybe a weaker Christian who didn't really have their principles thought through, I can see that could happen. You know, they start dating somebody and the person has different priorities and they say, instead of going to the church on Sunday afternoon, why don't you come with me to the mosque or to the Hindu temple, or even just, why not join me in my secular agnosticism? And, you know, gradually, because you haven't got really strong Christian moorings, you start to drift. I can see that could happen, but it won't happen to me. You see, my faith is pretty strong. And actually, our relationship is quite open, and we've talked about this, and we understand. And she's promised me that she doesn't mind I'm a Christian, and she doesn't particularly want to interfere with that. And she sees it has some good qualities, actually. It makes me a nice guy to be around. So I get the warning, but I think I'm safe. I'll do it. In other words, ignore the warning. I know you said it, God, but I don't think it applies to me. That's basically what Solomon does, isn't it? The Lord warned him, verse 2, you shall not intermarry with them. And yet, verse 2, he does. And so, verse 3, his wives turned away his heart. And the way it's written, it's obvious that it's absolutely inevitable. It just follows like one domino toppling into the neighboring domino, topples into the next domino. That once you've started the domino run, you can't stop them falling. Look at the language. God says they will turn your heart after other gods. Solomon doesn't believe him. But verse 4, his wives turned away his heart. Verse 5, his wives turned away his heart. So I'm one verse out, so it should say verse 3, his wife turns away his heart. Verse 4, his wives turned away his heart. Verse 9, his heart had turned away. And at the end of that, you've got to say, well, God was right. You know, the warning turned out to be right. It wasn't an empty warning. It really happened just the way God said. I mean, admittedly, it happens on a quite extreme scale, right? So God says no marriages with people who worship other gods. And Solomon does 700 weddings. Now, this just makes the mind boggle, doesn't it? Especially if recently you've organized one wedding, or you can remember organizing your wedding. 700 weddings. I did the maths. He reigned for 40 years. 700 wives means, I don't know if they're equally spread out across his reign, but if they were, that's one every 3 weeks for 40 years. And that's amazing. You can imagine, in some ways it would make things easier, wouldn't it? Economies of scale. You buy all the champagne in one go. I know that guy at the back just done a trip to France to get some wine. I guess Solomon did the equivalent to bring back the champers in bulk. And, you phone the florist and you got an account and, hi, it's Solomon here. Oh, yeah, I've been expecting you. The usual, please, this time. And you got an account with the jewelers to get the rings made, etc. But 700, he goes really a long way into this, doesn't he? He devotes himself to it. And partly it's what you did if you're rich and if you're successful. If you've got £1 billion income a year, then you have 700 wives. It's just, for the ancient world, you measure your success in how big your harem is. And it's rather sordid, isn't it? As well as 700 wives who get to be princesses, there's the 300 who just share his bed, but don't even get that. So it's not a very nice picture at all. It's a slightly exploitative picture. But it's a way of ignoring the warnings, big style. And actually, rather than just having two dominoes, as I've got here, maybe we actually need 700 dominoes. Because I guess the way that you get started marrying 700 foreign women is you marry one foreign woman. And you go, oh, wasn't zapped by lightning. Let me just check. Do I still believe the Ten Commandments? There's no other God but me. Yeah, I still believe that. Seems to be okay. God's threat is exaggerated. So I'll try it again. Two weddings. No lightning. Still going okay. Did you notice the little detail in the verses? In verse 4, when Solomon was old, his wives turned away his heart. So I guess the weddings have been going on for a long time. Be odd to save all your marriages until the very end of your reign. I guess all the way through his reign is making these compromises. But they don't come home to roost until much later. And I guess maybe that's what gave him the impression, I'm getting away with this. It's not having the effect on me. But it does. And God's right. And it happens. There's a kind of echo, isn't there, of the Garden of Eden? A warning, you shall not eat from the tree in the middle of the garden. If you do, you'll die. And they think, we won't die. And so they eat the tree. And you know what? They don't even die the same day. They don't even die immediately. So they probably thought, well, look, it's been okay. We've got away with it. But eventually they die, and God's right, and the warning was true. And in this case, domino one, domino 700, it leads to the really extreme thing. You compromise on the seemingly innocent thing. I was just in love with her and her and her and her. And her. It's a bit crazy, isn't it? But it was just love, and it ends up a long, long way away. Solomon, verse 5, went after Ashtoreth, the goddess of the Sidonians, and after Milcom, the abomination of the Ammonites. We don't know these names, but I guess if you lived in the ancient Near East, you would know some of these pagan gods and all the terrible practice they were known for. Yeah, he even went after him, even after Milcom, that abominable deity. Verse 6, he did what was evil in the sight of the Lord. Verse 7, he built a high place, like an altar, a worship center. That's twisted, isn't it? Remember, Solomon's the guy who builds the temple. He builds the great wonder of the world where you can worship the true God. And he also builds the mini temple, the one on the hill. That one over there on that hill, oh yeah, that's for Chemosh, the tour guide says. And that one over there, you see that hill over there, yeah? East of Jerusalem, yeah, that would be for Molech. And so for all of his foreign wives, I guess that's, well, probably not 700 different altars because there'll be some doubling up, won't there? But for the Molech wives, oh, there's your Molech shrine. And so step 3, God is angry with you. God is very angry. Why would God be angry with me for being in love? No. God's angry with Solomon for putting his fingers in his ears and going la, 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 and going further and further and further and further until his back was turned entirely on God. Do you see how the author makes us feel how right God is to be angry and how wrong Solomon was in his sin? The Lord is angry with Solomon, who turned away from the Lord, who had appeared to him twice. I mean, it's pretty rare in the Old Testament to get a personal theophany, to get God actually speak to you directly. That is a rare privilege, and Solomon gets that twice. He had such access to the truth about God, and yet he turned away from God. Verse 10, he commanded him concerning this very thing. Didn't I say specifically, you must not enter into a marriage with somebody who doesn't share your faith in the true God? But he didn't keep the Lord's command. Therefore, the Lord said to Solomon, since this has been your practice, I will tear the kingdom from you. And verse 14, the Lord raised up an adversary against Solomon, Hadad the Edomite. Verse 23, God raised up an adversary to him, Rezon, the son of Eleada, and so on. Now, the way this is written in 1 Kings is very deliberate, because presumably these battles have been going on for some time. Certainly the marriages have been going on for some time. The altars have been built over some time. But the author keeps it back and doesn't tell us about the dark secrets of Solomon's reign until chapter 11. I guess he wants us to enjoy the rose-tinted picture, and it has been that. If you remember back, the Queen of Sheba arriving, remember, she saw Solomon's city. It took her breath away. And we get that summary that everyone was happy on the surface. But actually, all this has been going on, and the author's kept it back so that we can see the horror that what was so wonderful can come crashing down. And step by step by step, domino by domino by domino, until Solomon is so far from God that we never actually find out whether Solomon will be in heaven. The New Testament doesn't make it clear. We hear about people like Moses and David and Solomon. We just don't know. It's a question mark over his future, with no particular grounds for optimism. So what do we do with this lesson today? Over the sheet, the other second half of the handout application, I've put there, use the Who Am I tool. Those of you who are part of our midweek grace groups on Wednesday, little shout out for those. If you're not, you're very welcome. We meet Wednesday by Wednesday to study the Bible together in groups. And we've been looking at various principles to help us be better Bible students. And one of them we've called the Who Am I tool. And it's just the principle that when we read a Bible story, we need to hesitate before we immediately assume it's about me or about us. So you look at the characters in the story, and it isn't necessarily representing you. So for example, Solomon, in some ways, is quite unique, isn't he? I mean, he is the king. So if I read the story of Solomon building the temple and assume I'm going to build the temple, you know, I'm not. If I read the story of Solomon earning £1 billion a year and that's my expectation of my income, then I'm going to be disappointed. It's not a sort of immediately a picture of me. In general, when we're reading stories about the kings of Israel, we ought to think about them applying to particular people, the kings of God's people. Come to that in a moment. But in this case, the book of Nehemiah helps us. And even though Solomon was in lots of ways unique, the wisest man he'd ever lived, a king, a very rich man, in this respect, Nehemiah says, he functions as a warning to ordinary people of God, people like us. Here's a quote from Nehemiah. In those days, this is sometime after the reign of Solomon, in those days, I saw the Jews who had married women of Ashdod, Ammon, and Moab. This is bad news. Remember, don't intermarry with them, otherwise they'll turn your heart away. Once again, they're doing it. Half the children spoke the language of Ashdod. They couldn't even speak the language of Judah, but only the language of each people. I confronted them and cursed them and beat some of them and pulled out their hair. If you remember when we did this in midweek groups, we found out the same thing happens to Ezra and Nehemiah. They both get very, very upset. And Ezra expresses his upset by pulling out his own hair. And Nehemiah expresses how upset he is by pulling out their hair. So there's a little interesting insight into their relative personalities. Nehemiah, quite a bully, obviously, but he's very, very upset. And he says to them, I made them take an oath in the name of God, saying, you shall not give your daughters to their sons or take their daughters for your sons or for yourselves. Didn't Solomon, king of Israel, sin on account of such women? Among the many nations, there was no king like him, and he was beloved by his God, and God made him king over all Israel. Nevertheless, foreign women made even him to sin. Even the wisest man gets tripped up by this. And you think you're wiser or safer? Shall we listen to you and do all this great evil and act treacherously against our God by marrying foreign women? Just a note to the women amongst you, by the way, it's not just that women are singled out here. It's basically because in that culture, it was men who decided who they were going to marry. That's why it's phrased this way around. But you could equally say to the women, don't commit this evil by marrying foreign men. Just that in those days, women weren't the one initiating the relationship. Heed the warning. If you're a Christian, do not share your life with somebody who's not. God warns you, if you do, they will turn your heart away. And if you're thinking, no, not in my case. I'll be strong enough. She understands. We've talked this through. It's okay. You're basically saying to God, God, you're bluffing. God, you're exaggerating. God, you're lying. God, I think you'll find that I'm a bit wiser than Solomon was, even though he was the wisest man of all history. And God would say to us, you fool. So I've seen it. I guess most of us who've been Christians a long time have seen it. Friends who used to be going well as Christians, keen as Christians, and now they're not, and they've drifted. And again, it turns out to be because of a relationship and a compromise. And maybe it started off as a small compromise, number one, and then number two, and then number 700, and now they're by little steps, they're a long, 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 long way away. Ignore the warning. Get into worse sin. Make God angry and be nowhere. It can happen. It does happen. Make sure it doesn't happen. Now, a little aside here. There'll be some people here who will now be feeling very guilty and weighed down. I think it did happen. That's me. I did that. Maybe you're now in a difficult marriage with somebody who's not a believer. Maybe you look back on past compromises with terrible regret. And actually, such is the grace of God that at the same time as warning you not to, the Bible also addresses you if you have. And that's one of the beautiful things about the Bible. It's so realistic. Don't do it. It's very dangerous to do it if you have done it. And I can point you to some later scriptures afterwards if you'd like. But the headlines would be, stay in the marriage you're in. Don't get divorced just because you've realized that you shouldn't have got married. Now you're married, stay married. Try to win your husband over or your wife over by a godly Christian life. But wow, what a difficult situation it is for you. And if you're not in that situation, don't get into that situation. What would it take to topple you as a Christian? What would be your advice to a junior demon assigned to your case? I bet for many, many of us, it would be romance, relationship. That would be the place it would start. The most tempting, the seemingly most innocuous, smallest step, domino one, that leads all the way to the fall. If Solomon is me, that's the lesson. But it's actually a bit worse than that for Israel, because not only was Solomon one of the people of God who ought to have known better, he was also the king of the people of God. And so his personal actions have consequences far beyond just for him. Because of a bad king, the whole nation is torn apart. Verse 11, I will surely tear the kingdom from you and give it to your servant. Now this is a bit anticipating the story, and we'll read more in our series on 1 Kings. Suffice to say, if this was the high point, it's downhill afterwards. We're not going any higher up in that. We're going sharply down, and terrible things are going to start to happen quite soon, and are going to keep happening for two books' time, until in the end God's people find themselves in exile in Babylon. It gets worse, and it all went bad because the king went wrong. We still get something of that today, don't we? Things go more wrong if the person who sins is a Christian leader. So please pray for Andrew and I. Consequences beyond. Things go more wrong if the person concerned is has great power and responsibility over a nation. And you can go some, you know, you can lead a world war or a genocide or something like that. Things go most wrong when you're the Messiah. Solomon was the Messiah of the day. And the whole people of God is torn apart. But, and there's a bit of good news, even in this quite tough sermon, but because of a gracious God, the kingdom is preserved. The reason we had Mark give us that first reading from 2 Samuel, we heard God's promise to Solomon's father that your kingdom will endure forever before me. And the question is, what will God do with his promise of an eternal kingdom when a king stuffs up? And the answer is God's angry. The answer is that the shine is taken off the kingdom, and instead of peace, they start to have military defeat. God raised up Hadad. God raised up Rezin. Instead of prosperity, there starts to be poverty. Instead of happiness, there starts to be woe. It all unravels. There's a civil war. The kingdom's torn in pieces, but it's not obliterated. And even all the way through the grim chapters to follow, God keeps his faithful promise. Did you see verse 12? Yet for the sake of David your father. Verse 13, however, for the sake of David my servant. Read on to verse 32. But he shall have one tribe for the sake of my servant David and for the sake of Jerusalem, which I've chosen. Verse 34. Nevertheless, I won't take the whole kingdom out of his hand for the sake of David my servant, whom I chose. Real trouble, real ruin. But the sin of a bad king is met by the grace of a very faithful God. And so the story keeps going. And Solomon's son, even though he's a total idiot, we'll see about more about that next week, do you come back? A guy called Rehoboam messes things up further. And his son and his son and his son and his son, some of them are much, much worse even than Solomon was. But they keep going, and his son, his son, his son, his son, his son, until we get to a king who's not very like Solomon at all. Well, in some ways he's like him. He's wise, he's rich, actually owns the entire universe. But he never ignores God's words, never makes the smallest compromise, domino one. Never ends at the end of the run, domino 700. A king who is faithful. Now that is very encouraging, isn't it? As Christians, we look to King Jesus, who will never do a Solomon. There's no danger of the whole thing being ruined at the top. But there's still a danger of it being ruined down here if I ignore Jesus' words and turn my back on Jesus. He's safe, the king is safe, so do not harden your heart. If anyone thinks he stands firm, let him take heed lest he fall. And if you're here in church today and you're thinking, to be honest, the dominoes are starting to fall already. And I can see them starting to chase down the domino run. And maybe we're at domino 200 and 300. You probably need help to stop it. You're not going to be able to stop them toppling by yourself. So take the warning. Talk to somebody today and turn back. Ask for God's mercy to turn back before it goes any further.